It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azure Talon? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Okay, previously on the magical talking hat, you'll remember I had a new medication that I had to inject into myself.
Yeah.
And then I wasn't sure I was doing it because it had that sheath on it with the needle, and you put that and it said it was so sharp you might not feel the needle.
Oh yeah.
And I wasn't feeling it, and I'd only done it the once. Well, after we podcast last time, I did it a second time, same thing. I stood up that time, was looking in the mirror, I did it, and I'm still like, I don't know, this is weird. And then when I went to tuck Trishan to bed later that night, she's like, so I've been reading up on the instructions for this online, that pink sheath is actually an inner cap and you're supposed to take it off and there's just a needle and then you jam the needle into yourself. So went and did that instead. Still couldn't feel it. It's a really thin, really sharp needle, but I mean, I could see that I was jabbing a needle into myself. But yeah, it means that the first two times I was just taking the pen, dialing up the meds, poking myself with some plastic, and then just squirting medicine everywhere.
Oops.
So, but yeah, now I'm actually doing it and it's crazy effective.
What do you mean?
My blood sugar is, my morning blood sugar I take is way lower. And they said an appetite suppressant. It's not making me like not want to eat when it's time to eat. I'm getting full way faster though. So I'm definitely eating a lot less too. It's like right away happening.
Interesting.
Some of the side effects are only just starting to kick in and they are not super fun, but they should be temporary. So. So yeah, it's going really well. I'm really psyched about it.
Okay, good.
And today we're getting the downward angle. I'm keeping the computer on my leg instead of normally when it would be like here, this. Because a lot of listeners, or viewers really, not the people who listen, have said they can't see up my nose enough and they would like more. So helping with that. So, there you go. Hello, everyone. See, I did that like I was somewhere else, and I was like, oh, hi, I didn't notice you. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world brave enough and smart enough to take the dangerous, high-stakes world of illegal drag racing and bring it to podcasting. Hasn't proven super effective yet, but we're still hopeful. I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 497.
All right. It's only 497?
Yeah. Is it? Don't make me doubt myself.
It makes me worried that I got the date wrong for 500 then.
Well, I didn't really count it out, so I hope not.
798. No, that's right. 99 is on the 8th, and then 500 is on the 10th because we got to record it the Saturday before. All right, we're good.
Okay.
Speaking of, invitations have gone out for episode 500. I sent them out today. If you did not receive them, check your spam folder, the usual deal. Outside of that, if you didn't receive them, it means either I didn't think you wanted to participate, or I totally forgot that you told me you wanted to participate. So if either of those things is true, email me or the hat, whichever, and let me know, and I will send you the invite. Rather than contact Stu or Mark, who I both thought might want to be involved, but I've just stuck them on there because I realized I don't care. Like, nobody, we're not, there's no RSVP issue here. Like, whoever's there is there, and we'll do a podcast.
Yeah, we don't have to adjust.
Kind of like we do here.
Yeah, we don't have to adjust how many donuts we're going to get or something.
Yeah, nothing like that. Like, it'll just be like, oh, okay, it's this many. All right. So yeah, but if everybody shows up, we may have like 10 or 11 people. And like one or two people listening.
Who aren't actually in the thing.
Yeah. In terms of actual regular listeners or viewers of our podcast, I can, off the top of my head, only think of one that's not on that list. Again, unless I forgot stuff, which I'm sure I must have. But and it's somebody who has never written in, and I very much don't believe they want to be involved. But if they do, they can let me know, and I'll do it. Yeah, so that's going to be a really boring episode for a lot of people because they're going to be like, we lived it.
We lived it.
Like, for me, that's how it is for me all the time. Is like, I don't listen because I'm like, I lived it. I was there. For those of you just joining us, we're planning our 500th episode. So you are late. But let me explain how this works. We have a hat. It is magical. In that it has its own email address. Isn't that magical? TheMagicalTalkingHat@gmail.com. I wonder if in the future people will think this is silly because all hats will have email addresses.
Mm.
But at the time here, on our current time, it's unusual, nay magical, for a hat to have its own email address. TheMagicalTalkingHat@gmail.com. People, good, kind-hearted, helpful people, possibly some animals, write into that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little notes, comments, questions, topics, things like that. The hat, all on its own, magically transmogrifies those little emails into note cards with the information written on them that manifest physically within the hat itself. Illegal street racing servants draw the note cards out of the hat at random, read them on the air, talk about them till we're bored, do that for about an hour. That's the whole show except the parts that aren't, which is most of the show. I notice I'm looking this way a lot today, and I would like to say there's something over here distracting me, but there's not. I have no idea why I keep looking over that way, but I am. It's weird.
That is weird.
So, how's your week been?
It's been fine. Lovecraft Country is...
It's getting weird.
Well, it's not just weird. It seems like it's more gross than it was when it started out.
It's deviating from the book more and more, so maybe they're finding more places. Because yeah, the last episode, no part of that had anything to do with the book. There are no Korean people in the book of Lovecraft Country. There are no characters. There is no one named. While Atticus did serve in the Korean War, and that is mentioned, like, nobody specific ever comes up. Certainly no part of it is ever set there. None of that. I kind of liked this episode as a standalone thing. But as I really don't feel like this show needs this extra plot in here. So, and apparently a lot of Korean descended people found it, according to one reviewer I read, problematic as fuck.
Well, yeah, there's that, but it's also just, I mean, just, you know, I'm not the person that usually enjoys horror that's like really gory and stuff. I mean, that's just a personal preference. That's just a personal preference. So you know, when it, when a lot of things are happening on the screen that I'm just not interested in seeing, or it makes me feel a little sick to see it. It's like, again, other people, if they're into that, that's fine. I don't care. But it's just, it just doesn't do it for me. And it kind of takes me out of whatever else is going on. So I have a hard time getting into whatever the rest of the story is, if there is a rest of the story. Because some, that's another thing about the last two episodes. It seemed like it was light on other aspects of the story and heavy on Gross. It's just like, to me. But maybe that's just because I it bothered me so much that it just distracted from whatever else was going on. I don't know.
Maybe, because when I think about it, it was, the last couple episodes have been gorier. It didn't particularly stick out for me. I'm not into gore, but I frequently can sort of just ignore it, especially if it's stuff that is not, again, it's a realism thing. If you show me a realistic portrayal of someone, you know, getting sliced up or something, that will fuck me up. But, you know, hairy tentacles and people exploding.
That seems kind of realistic to me. I don't know. I mean, not how it.
How many hairy tentacles you run into?
Not how it happened, but a person blowing up. I mean, people do blow up, and it looks like what a person would look like if they blew up.
I have no idea what a person would look like.
I know, but it's convincing to me is what I'm saying. And I'm like, that's, I don't want to see that. It's gross. Ugh. So I don't know. And the previous thing with, like you said, the sloughing off of skin and stuff, I mean, that looked very convincing. Of course, you know, that doesn't happen to in real life. I know, but it's like, it just looked really convincing. It's like this.
Yeah,
this
I would rather they not have done that. I definitely would have preferred not to have that.
Ugh. And just having it still in my head, I'm usually really good at forgetting things I want to forget, but these things are sticking with me a little bit more than I would like them to. I mean, in 6 months from now, I won't remember them, but.
Yeah, you will. I'm going to remind you.
Well, I might not. You'd have to show it to me. You can't just describe it.
All right. I'll make note. I'll do it.
I'm that good at forgetting. No, don't show it to me. I don't want to see that stuff. Come on. It's gross. Ugh.
You ever put blood into a balloon and then.
So, yeah, I don't. I mean, it's getting to the point where I'm not sure it's going to be worth it for me to watch it, because I won't get anything out of it if I'm just can't even look at the screen and I'm going to feel grossed out for large portions of it. And I won't even be able to appreciate whatever the story is, whatever they're trying to say. I just don't know if it's going to be my kind of thing in the end.
Well, you can read the book instead.
That's true.
I love the book.
It's true. I could do that. That might be more my speed. But, you know, this is getting too much. And we're tonight, they released two episodes of Raised by Wolves.
Oh, man, again.
And we already watched them.
There's only one episode left after this.
I guess.
I think there's only 10. I'm continuing not to like the show. I'm continuing to watch it for some reason.
Well, I mean, at this point, it feels like, well, not at this point. From the very beginning, you get the impression that, you know, if you're interested like I am in science fiction, I'm interested in this, you know, speculative fiction aspects of it. Like, I would be perfectly happy with science fiction. It doesn't mess with drama or romance or metaphor. It's just straight up a, you know, what might the world look like 100 years from now? That's all it really was. That's all its goal was, is to speculate on, you know, what might happen in the future with the barest plot to you know, give you, to follow along to show you these things. I'd be perfectly happy with that. It doesn't need to make any kind of point or have any kind of agenda or like I said, metaphor or politics or anything like that. Although it's fine if it has those things. I can be perfectly satisfied with just a futurism or, you know, aspect to speculative fiction. But then you get something like what this is, and it's not really about speculative science fiction at all. It's using this setting to make some kind of point, and I'm not sure I can always understand or really ever understand what it is they're trying to say.
Oh, no, and I don't think we'll ever figure. I think it's very much going to suffer like Lost, where a bunch of the shit that happens that's mysterious is never going to get explained. I can already feel that.
So,
and yeah. It's, again, people, go to IMDb. look at all the movies Ridley Scott has done and ask yourself, how many of them do you genuinely think were good? Because I think we've been fooling ourselves with a lot of these.
But he did Alien, right?
He did exactly. He did Alien. And that was good. And then he did a bunch of other stuff.
Good. Yeah, I don't know. Because to me, Alien, my wife and I recently watched, as I probably mentioned, all of the Alien movies. We got this DVD set where they were all in there.
Yeah, I got one of those.
And we watched them all one day. And it was really fun to watch them. And interestingly... The second one was the weakest one, the one that was fit the least in the whole thing. I mean, we like the second one for various reasons, like a lot of people like it. But
I'd say it's one of the most popular of them, yeah.
Yeah. But in the context of the larger narrative, it does not fit at all, not in tone, not in really any way. And it actually was kind of annoying having it in the... in the set, because it's like it took this first, you have this, to me, a brilliant film that Alien is, and then what follows it is really not as good, really, on any level. I mean, it's still fun in a lot of ways, but it doesn't, like I said, the tone is completely off with it. And then the other movies, which again have their own problems, at least they're consistent in tone and a little bit in theme, and they're kind of interesting in those respects. But
you heard it here first, people. William just crapping all over Bill Paxton's grave.
No, that's one of the things we liked about the second one was Paxton. But yeah, when you put them all together, it's like it doesn't fit at all. It's not that great in comparison. And I'm saying that even not liking some of the later films. But the first one was so good, and it was so thought out.
Don't get super excited. Anytime people get too excited about how great Alien is, just remember micro changes in air pressure.
What?
That was how they tracked the alien, device that recorded micro changes in air. It's a great movie for what it is.
Well, what
it's
I like...
It's not a perfect film by any stretch.
No, of course not. But it's... What I really appreciate about it was all of the subtle things. You know, the design of it, the world building in it, you know, that they're not beating you over the head with. It's just there. How convincing the actors were in their roles. I mean, it was completely believable who they were and what they were doing and what their... you know, what their lives were like and what motivated them. It was like, this is just really good how this is put together. And in fact, that was something that was lacking in some of the later movies that seemed to be trying to tell you something all the time instead of just showing it to you. And so, yeah, I mean, not a perfect film. You're right. But there was just a lot of good film craft in it is what I'm getting
at. It's good. I think it's a good movie.
And some of the later movies tried to do some of that, but then on top of doing those things, it tried to tell you something all the time, and I'm not sure why.
Well, and different people made each one.
Yeah. Well,
Scott didn't do any of those follow-ups. He did Prometheus and Covenant.
Which were terrible, except for I liked Fassbender's, you know, portrayal in his character was, I thought, really good, but a lot of it was really awful. I don't know how that happened. But yeah, I mean, that's a good point you're making. What other film from Ridley Scott can I think of that impressed me as much as Alien did? And I can't think of one.
But he has a definite style, and this show feels very much, even though he's not directing them, he's just the EP on this. And I am having fun because it is clear that not only is it a common aesthetic feature, milk is clearly a plot point in this series. And so it's one of those, is this an homage or a satire?
Right.
So I'm curious about that. But yeah.
Something else we did this week is we never finished Warehouse 13. We never finished it.
You know, I didn't either.
But it's on Peacock.
Oh, okay.
you know, which is free with ads. So if you can stand watching the ads, we finished it. We finished Warehouse 13.
I eventually read up. I mean, I watched the episode that was the resolution of the cliffhanger from the penultimate season.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't watch after that, but I eventually went and read up. And it was one of those things where we were DVRing at the time and one of the DVR things got screwed up. And
I mean, watching the show again all these years later, I still thought it was very fun. I liked the design of it. I liked the premise of it. And some of the acting was good. Not all of it. And the plots were usually not even close to being good.
No.
Some of the artifacts were clever, but a lot of them weren't. I don't know why they were so uneven with that. But I did think it was fun. I mean, if there were more seasons of it, I'd probably, you know, if they'd had one or two more seasons that we didn't watch, I'd watch them. They were fun.
Once you're in, it helps. I am now just over halfway through the second season of 12 Monkeys. Hmm. And we are getting into our stride here. We are being funny a lot. We're being very ensemble-y about it. Frequently, each episode has like a main plot and a couple of subplots dealing with different people in different places. We're getting there. We are still in that phase of basic cable television where the show feels it has to keep our attention by having a major twist every episode, which is fine. I feel like, honey, you need to relax more. I'm with you. Like, you don't have to impress me every time. So we aren't into episodes yet. We don't have a solid framework where, oh, we do this every, you know, we don't have a monster of the week vibe yet. And that would almost be easier, but I'm having fun with it. I'm still seeing a lot of, hey, that's the dude from Killjoys in this episode. Hey, that's the guy from Battlestar Galactica. Like all the workhorse Canadian sci-fi actors show up for like an episode or two. And I'm like, I know that one.
What's that show that you showed me when I was over there? Is it Joe Pera? Is that right? Joe Pera talks to you. Talks to you. So he's on something. He's on Peacock or
Adult Swim.
So it must be on HBO Max.
Could be.
Anyway, so I showed my wife the first one of those. She didn't really get it, I don't think.
Super soothing. They're very nice.
I thought it was, you know, I remember seeing it before. Maybe it wasn't the right one to show her. Maybe I should have.
If it was one of the early specials, it didn't work as well. Yeah, they're not. It's not perfectly even, but when you get it, you can sort of adapt after that once you're in the right frame of mind. But it's earnestness as comedy is not for everybody. I very much enjoy it. Whereas like I don't enjoy, say, cringe comedy as much. Mm. Or we finished watching The Duchess, the Catherine Ryan show that I had mentioned. Comedian Catherine Ryan did a sort of semi-autobiographical, it's not really autobiographical, but it pulls a lot from her actual life to do this thing. And it was good, but there's a thing about British comedy, especially when it's like the half-hour sitcom variety, where Brits think it's incredibly funny if people's lives fall apart. Mm. And I always find that very stressful.
Oh.
And so that doesn't always apply. We've checked out a couple of new comedies this week, though.
Oh, what are they?
One we've been planning for a while that's Woke on Hulu.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We've only watched the pilot. I really liked it.
Hmm.
It is very clever. Again, somewhat autobiographical, although that's weird because it is the story of a guy who starts seeing things talking and hearing voices. But It's the story. Well, okay. If anybody watched New Girl, the pilot for New Girl, Zooey Deschanel moved in with three guys, and one of them was black and was played by Damon Wayans Jr. After the pilot, they couldn't get him anymore. So the second episode, he moved out and a different black guy moved in. And he became the black guy for New Girl. Mm. It's that actor. I don't know his name. But it's him. And I really liked him in New Girl for as long as I watched it. And it's him playing a comic artist who is about to go big. He's going to have national syndication. Mm. And he is black, but he writes a fairly uncontroversial comic strip. It's called Toast and Butter, and those are the two characters, and like, it's not, you know, it's very mainstream, not no message involved or anything like that particularly. And then while this is happening, he has a bad experience with the police, and this basically causes him to freak out a little bit and become aware of, like, it nudges into outline all of these aspects of life that he was aware of before, but that, like, really he's hyper aware of them now. And one of the side effects, and a sort of a comedic thing, is various objects speak to him and are, like, cartoonish and talk to him about things, and that's sort of the goofy angle. But it's this idea of, like, yeah, he suddenly is becoming aware of racism in everyday life on a level that he sort of knew, but, like, now it's really sinking home for him, and so that's making it difficult for him to try and, you know, move forward with his career and all that. But it's very clever, and it's got a very good cast, and I like it. We also watched, because my sister just tossed it out here at me, another show on Netflix called Kim's Convenience. And it is a Canadian sitcom, and it has four seasons on Netflix. I think there are two more seasons out there. And all it is a Korean family owns and operates a convenience store in the middle of Toronto, and hijinks ensue. And I think it's a little bit like Fresh Off the Boat. I think it's based off of, like, a book that somebody wrote about their, like, family experience and stuff. But it's very much, it's reminiscent a little bit of Corner Gas, if anybody watched that Canadian sitcom. But instead of a small town in Saskatchewan, it's the middle of Toronto. It's very cute. It's very standard sitcom. Like, people do bad things, and then at the end of the episode, they learn a lesson, and basically at the end of every episode, everything's back to where it was before, and, you know, that kind of thing. It's done in very broad strokes and all that, but it's funny. I liked it, and it's, you know, I'm desperately looking for some shows right now that aren't heavy mm-hmm. and aren't sad, and, like, Woke is hilarious, but it's still dealing with the reality of institutional racism. Like, it's still a heavy show in that way. Like, this show, it's fine. Like, it's just fun. It's just there. And it's not great, but it's good. I liked it. And in the very first episode, a drag queen shows up, and I realized it was played by the actor who played Pree on Killjoys, which is the best character on Killjoys ever, and that was super awesome. So that was good. I think that's all. I've barely been watching. I'm still. Oh! I figured out why I'm playing Kingdoms of Amalur: Re-Reckoning.
I thought you just wanted to do it.
Yeah, but remember, I didn't know why.
Oh.
Because I kind of didn't want to do it. Remember, I didn't like. I had issues with the game, yeah, and I'm like, for some reason, I bought it, and for some reason, I played it, and I've now put like 25 hours into it already.
Okay, why?
I figured it out.
Do tell.
Because, due again to the debacle that was its creation in the world and what it was supposed to be and then what it ended up being, Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning, and also Kingdoms of Amalur: Re-Reckoning, which is the same game, is in a very real, genuine sense, a single-player MMORPG. Not just an open-world RPG. Like, it operates the way MMOs do in terms of you go to the regions and they're different quests, and the quests are all kind of similar in a way, and a lot of, like, it plays like WoW.
Yeah.
But you're the only person there. And that's a terrible idea for a game. Like, if it's single player, it doesn't need all the shortcuts in MMO. Like, you can make a better story, you can, like, all sorts of stuff if you're not doing an MMO. But at the same time, part of me, that's all I've ever wanted, was to just play World of Warcraft without all the other stupid fuckers there. And a part of me still does. And that part of me is really enjoying this.
Okay.
So if that resonates with anyone, you might like this game. Because I always tried various MMOs, and what it came down to is I'm like, I don't like playing with other people. And I want to, but it just doesn't work. This game is really cool, but all these other fuckers... And not only are they in my way and annoying, and some of them have terrible names and they're doing stupid dances and distracting me, but also in a lot of cases I have to join up with them if I want to play certain parts of the game. I don't know that. So this is just a single player version. So it's fun. And I'm trying to play it differently than I played it last time. And so that's been kind of cool. But yeah, so I'm playing a lot of that. I joined Scriblophile, the writing community.
So, yeah, when you told me that you'd finished your book or whatever, I asked how you were feeling about that. You didn't really say anything. I presumed you wanted to talk about it on the podcast, maybe?
Oh, yeah. I thought I already... No, I didn't, because I guess I finished it Saturday, didn't I? I finished the book.
Yeah.
Book's done.
Yep.
Yeah, finished. Ready to sell. I am pleased. I am very pleased. I am glad it is done and that I can do other things now and that I can work on selling it and I can get to the part where I'm like a real honest-to-goodness author, and that I can write some other things that I've been thinking about in my head and I can start on a sequel and that kind of thing. It doesn't feel as exciting because, as I've said many times, the bit at the end isn't the impressive part. In my opinion, it's not the part that took my creativity and talent. All it took was my patience and slow plotting to get it to a polished form. And it took longer than it took to just write the book originally. Like, and so that doesn't feel as much of an accomplishment as back when I was like, hey, I wrote a freaking book. But it's still good, and it does feel like an accomplishment, and it's a real thing. Like, a lot of people do NaNoWriMo in November, and they write a thing, and I have read some things that people have written for NaNoWriMo, and what they are jumbles of words that with a lot of editing and rewriting and changes could be a good story, and they never get beyond that point. And so I am pleased that I'm like, this is a real grown-up book that I would feel comfortable with just self-publishing and putting on Amazon right now as is.
Let me ask a question that's going to seem like it's changing the subject, but it's not. When did you and I start where we worked previously, like, you know, having daily conversations and, like, you know, was it only when you came and worked on my team, or was it before that?
No, I think our friendship, such as it is, began when I moved to the Vision team.
And when was that exactly?
When did we work there?
Well, I left in 2006, so
probably 03 or 04.
Okay. So
I started there in 01. So yeah, it was probably 03 or 04.
Oh, you think you worked over in accounting for like 3 years or so?
Two or three, and then two or three in Vision.
Okay.
I only worked there for 6 years, 01 to 07.
So we've probably been friends for like 15, 16, maybe 17 years?
Yeah, more than 15, less than 20.
So that's a long time. But I remember very early on, you and I talked about the prospect of you writing a book that long ago, like I say, 15 years ago. And oh, yeah. I remember at the time you feeling very skeptical about you ever being interested in doing it, or that you, like, you'd, even if you got interested in doing it, you'd start and you'd get bored or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this seems like a pretty big deal to me. that you're at this point.
It's an extremely big deal. It's just most of the big deal part happened earlier. So amazement and plea, but no, and I, this is one of those things. I've essentially wanted to be a writer my entire life.
Sure. Yeah.
And you know, sometimes it's taken a backseat, sometimes it hasn't. And I haven't worked really hard at it ever.
Right.
I would go in fits and starts. And even then, like, I would get really inspired and I would write a short story. I would never go back and rewrite it or anything right. like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, and I dealt with stuff in college and I dealt with people saying to me, you know, if you really were going to be a writer, you'd probably be writing.
You told me that once.
Yep, and it was super shitty, but it was also not wrong. Not every good writer says it, but a lot of them do. The key to actually being a real writer is you got to write a lot. It doesn't have to be good. It doesn't, what, at least to start with, but you just have to write a lot. It's a muscle. It's a habit. And I'm still not that great at that. I mean, it's taken me years to get this one, but I'm working on it, and I have more faith in my abilities than I used to. But yeah, by the time you and I met, I had soaked in the reality that, like, this was, why would this happen? This was not going to happen. I had spent decades not doing it.
Well, there is a flaw in the statement, if you were going to be a writer, you'd be writing. There is a flaw in that logic. And that is, writing ultimately is just a kind of storytelling. And there are a lot of people who are like you, for example, who are storytelling all the time. Maybe they're not writing it. Maybe they're not writing pages, but storytelling is a huge part of who they are and their life. And they're doing that. And to say that if they're not actually physically writing something down, they're not actually working the muscles that you would use to write is not exactly accurate. I mean, writing does take a certain type of skill and whatever, but the storytelling muscles can still be worked.
Yeah, but in a lot of cases, like the way I was living my life, it was far more likely I, for example, would have gone into stand-up than writing. And to be fair, I believe this really gut-wrenching advice was given to me at a time when I said, well, what I really want to be is a writer, but it seems like I'm never writing anything, which was true. At that point, it had been years since I had written any stories. And so it's really weird to be like, what I want to do is write stories, but I'm not like that. So, I mean, I got it. And, you know, I took it personal at the time and it was depressing for a while, but it wasn't wrong. And the way I got around it is I just wrote.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right.
That's and, exactly. And now the trick is to not rest on that. And I didn't rest on that in that I edited it and finalized it and now it's a real live book. Now I have to not rest on having done that once. So we'll see. And it's hard now because the other thing I'm doing is homemaking. And homemaking is much more direct. I spend an hour doing something and afterwards I have tangible, visible proof as to what I did.
Yeah.
Writing, I mean, so much of that, but I'm hoping this community is going to help. I've joined, I haven't done anything yet, but I'm hoping a lot of it is reading other people's writing and giving them constructive criticism. And I feel like I'm good at that and I enjoy that. I also think reading a bunch of other people's writing will help inspire me.
Sure, yeah, right.
So we'll have to see from here, but yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Oh, I'm sorry, and I kind of interrupted you. What's the service you're using again?
Scribblophile.
Okay.
It's apparently really enormous. And it is free as a limited version. There's also a paid version. And I did, as I've been doing with a lot of things these days, I'm like, you know what? I think this might be something I'm interested in, but the free version is too limiting for me. And it's not a thing where I'm like, well, I'll try it this month and see if I'm any good. So what I did is I spent $65 and I bought a year's premium subscription to it.
Oh, I see.
And so if after a year I'm like, I'm not using this, I will stop and I will have spent $65. Which is fair, I think, for exploring this. So it's the same thing I've done with the streaming services, like with BritBox and those. I do them yearly because a month is too short. Sometimes, depending on what's going on in that month, you didn't have time to watch anything, or you were really into something that was on a different streaming service, and so you were watching a ton of that.
A year, really, for a whole year.
Yeah, but if you spend a whole year, you're like, I haven't watched it at all, then you don't need it. If I spend a whole year and I'm like, I haven't been using this site at all, this community at all, then... And they got forums and stuff, and so I'm hoping I'm going to get good advice there on the whole trying to find an agent thing as well. Yeah, so we'll see.
Do you have any connections with the whole agent thing?
I know people who worked in the publishing industry. I do not personally know any agents. I know a couple of resources to find them, but that's a lot of it. It's a numbers game. I mostly just need to find agents that I think are in the wheelhouse of what I'm writing and send them a cover letter in the first three chapters. And if I do enough of them, hopefully somebody will write back and say, I want to see the rest of it. And if that happens enough, hopefully somebody will go for it.
Back in the day when I was looking for agents and publishers, I found some, and I don't remember who they were, or I would just tell you, but there were some groups, like publishing groups and or agent groups, that were primarily interested in highlighting, promoting, getting out there to publish works that featured like trans characters and the like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was back in the day. So
now, yeah, there are a lot of, the niche is too strong a word, but there are a lot of publishing companies now, because there are a lot of different ones out there, have specific interests, and I'm hoping that's going to be the thing. Like, because the simplest way I keep referring to my stuff now is SJW fan fiction, because I am coming from a position of not being able to write to the experience of people of color, women, or queer individuals at all, but I'm writing what I want out there, and what I want out there is a huge, diverse feminist spectrum of characters of all sorts of races and gender identities, skewed female. I like having more female characters than male, and that's just what I enjoy. And I have to be very careful that I'm not saying too much about the experience, because I can't. But those are the characters that I want. So hence SJW fan fiction. Is that for me? I was expecting a call.
Hello?
Hello.
It's for you.
Hi. What? I can't hear him.
You can't hear him?
No. I think you're operating on a different mic tonight.
I think they hung up.
I also think you're operating on a different mic tonight.
What? No.
You sounded different tonight. Go near the mic.
Oops. What happened?
It's been like that the whole time.
I lost your picture.
Oh, I don't.
No, wait, I'm off the thing. So can I check while we're going? I don't want to. No, I'll mute the mic by accident. Okay, can you hear me better if I put my face up to the microphone?
Oh, yeah. I guess you are using that mic. All right.
Yeah.
I don't know then. All right. But that's not where you put the phone.
Oh, yeah. I was handing it to your picture right there. See, I see you here on the computer. That was the problem.
I did that in gaming the other night. I did point at a character and said, you, And they're all like, we have no idea who that is. Also, I had an NPC making a gesture. And not only did I not do it on camera, I held it afterwards while being the NPC. And I finally was like, there's no reason to hold it. Also, I'm pretty sure they never saw it. And so I asked, and it was true. They never did.
Is it hard? Is it really? Is it a significant challenge to do these things in Zoom?
I would not say it is a challenge. You lose a lot. Mm. Part of it is, as you know here, the voice thing. We can't really talk at the same time, and it can cut things off. Yeah. And part of it is, this is the window I have to work with. It's almost entirely face. Even in podcasting, there's a lot of gestures I like to do, but in gaming, there's tons of that. And you're describing stuff and things like that. And certain NPCs have gestures that help bring across who they are, and you don't have that. So there's definite limits, but it works. It works.
Hmm.
I do miss the real thing. But. All right, we're running out of time. We should probably pull a thing.
I didn't really ask about your week, so I hope you got it covered anyway. Somehow.
Yeah, it pretty much was it.
Okay.
The medicine's been the most interesting bit. Yeah.
I really like that we've known each other for all this time. That makes me happy.
I've got a short list of those kinds of things. Certain groups of friends like that. Not many. And yeah, I've been spending a lot more time lately thinking about the individual relationships in my life, what they mean to me, and if I am behaving in a way that corresponds with what they mean to me.
That's a good thing to think about.
Well, it ties very strongly into a resource scarcity thing. I'm only willing to give so much to the people in my life as a whole. And so I don't want to just have a whole bunch of acquaintances. I mean, yeah. And I do, but I mean, like, you have to be on a specific list for me to really go to the mat for you. And that list is getting a lot more deliberate in my, it used to be like, oh, you know, I just do what I want to do. But nowadays I'm like, no, there are people in my life that I am choosing that they are important. And so I've got their back, whatever it is. And unsurprisingly, a lot of it is tied into people that I've known a long time, like I've known you.
Yeah.
But like I've recently, and it's a semantic thing on a certain level, but I've recently decided that the neighbors are family to me.
Sure.
I had decided a while back that the kids were essentially my niece and nephew because it was just easier. And I've talked about that before, but I realized, no, their parents are also family in a very real sense. We don't do a ton together. We have a lot in common, but we have a lot not in common.
Yeah.
But I'm there for them and
right.
I got their back and that's important to me.
That's nice. Anyway,
Jeebus. This is one from Azure Talent, and it is big.
Mm.
Oh, man. It was already abridged, but it's still big. Dear Hatsons, when making a character different from yourself in gaming or writing, how do you authentically represent them without being racist, sexist, etc.?
Well, to begin with, my whole life I've created characters for various things. My whole life. I mean, I don't remember a time where that wasn't true. And my experience with doing this, for however I'm doing it, if I'm telling a silly story to other kids when I was a kid or when I was older. One thing I used to like to do when I was a kid was if a kid had a doll or something, I would take it and I would move it around like a puppet and I would give it a character and it just would spontaneously come out. I didn't think about it. I didn't sit and craft it. But this character always had a distinctive personality, always said and did things that I didn't really plan. And so when I did puppeteering, it was the same. When I created a character for a puppet, it was the same. When I wrote sketches, it was the same. When I acted in sketches, it was the same. So this has always been the same kind of process. When the character is part of whatever I'm doing, even if I'm writing a novel, I kind of just let that character take over and decide. Now, as far as what happens when it's a female character and or a person of color and those things, I don't know for sure if I do, I mean, I want to respect its experience and things like that, the experience of a female character or a person of color or a non-heteronormative character. And I certainly try to do that in the crafting of it. You know, if it's a novel, there's a lot of crafting involved after I first put it down on the page. But for a lot of the characters I've created, they're just coming out spontaneously, or I'm just writing the sketch quickly and I'm going to perform it, you know, 30 minutes or 2 days later. And there might not be a lot of craft involved there. I mean, one time I did a character in improv I don't remember. I remember doing a character once that wasn't like me. I can't remember specifically how the character was different, if it was a female or what. And I wasn't at all satisfied afterwards that I'd been very respectful at all. In fact, I felt pretty bad about it, honestly. But only in the books that I've written where I have had female characters, and I had a female character who was black, and I had a Native American character who in my mind was not straight. I don't really know if I ever decided if she was bisexual or lesbian or whatever. She didn't have any relationships, but I just thought of her as, you know who I'm talking about too, I think.
Yeah.
And in those were situations where I was writing the novels where I actually had some time and I could really think about it. And you actually gave me some feedback on the Native American character where you said, you know, be careful here what you're doing. You don't want to tell a story that's not really yours. I remember that was a specific piece of good advice that you gave me. And now how did I do? I don't know. Nobody's really given me feedback on it. Nobody's ever come up to me and said, well, you write women really poorly, or you write black women really poorly, or whatever. Nobody's ever told me.
I think you did well in Twilight Nurse. Blue Hawk had some things, but it was really ambitious. And I haven't seen more recent.
Oh yeah. And it's changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it hasn't changed that much. I don't know.
I feel like we should talk. I know why Azure Talon wrote this.
Oh.
I mean, I don't know specifically, but from what I know of Azure Talon, I know what he is most interested in here. And it's a performative aspect. And what it mostly, in Azure Talon's case, it comes down to this. So you're playing a role-playing game, and you're playing a character that is a woman or of a different ethnicity than yours, or both. Doing an accent seems really offensive, but at the same time seems more accurate, like in certain situations. Like when I play a female character, or when I read to Trish and I'm reading one, I do an affect of my voice. It's not always just a higher pitch. Sometimes there's another affect involved. And a lot of characters I have in my games, they have accents that suit them. And in inherently, doing an accent doesn't have to be offensive, but the line at which it becomes offensive is practically invisible. Like, it's really hard to tell. And it especially gets weird if, like, I think I've talked before, one of my players has a black voice and they do it without thinking about it when there's a character of that sort of nature there and there's no malintent involved. And I will admit it sort of enriches things a little bit, but it feels weird. And especially now, because we've all heard it so many times, to notice the pattern, it's odd. And I mean, my answer to this is it's a very difficult question, and one that you constantly, constantly, constantly have to be asking at all times.
Yeah. I mean, you can base it, you can do research, or if it's like for a role-playing game and it's spontaneous, you can base it on people you know or people who you've actually taken the time to try to understand their experiences.
Yeah.
But unless you are one of those people, that's always going to be probably not deep enough for you to do real justice to that experience. And so you just have to ask yourself, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the rules are. You know what I mean? I don't know if it's okay to do this or if it's only bad if it offends somebody or what.
And, yeah, and it varies. And especially in a role-playing game where you're in a private scenario, it should only matter to that group. At the same time, it's really weird if you're like, okay, we're all white people here, so we can just do whatever. And that has happened with my group. We have gotten caught into a whole thing where at a certain point, we're all dying laughing because due to weird cyberpunk tropes we were playing with, we ended up doing an audible version of Clippy, the old paperclip from Word, but it's in VR and they have a really thick Asian accent. And it got super offensive. And it was isolated in that room. And we were all laughing and we were all also terribly ashamed at the same time. And we all had to acknowledge, like, this is horrible. We should not be doing this. I think, and I've talked about this before, I think you just constantly have to be checking with yourself. Why? Why? And this extends beyond performance. Now, obviously, why am I doing the accent? What is the impact of this accent? Do I think that, therefore, is a good idea? But with everything, this character, I gave them this trait. Did I give them this trait because they are a female character, as opposed to if this was a male character in the same role, I might not have given them this trait? If so, is that a stereotype? Is that understandable? Is it trivial? And it varies, and you have to keep, you can't set, as soon as you feel like you've got it down, you're in trouble. As soon as you feel like you have the flowchart worked out and you know what to do with it, that's bad, in my opinion. As soon as you're like, oh, this is okay when I'm making black characters, this is not, and those are the rules, then I think you're screwed. Each time you have to be like, why did I do this? What impact is it having in my story, in my gameplay, in my sketch? What is the reaction going to be? Is it necessary? Is it worth it?
Yeah.
Why does my eye itch so much?
When I was a kid, I was totally fascinated with accents, and I was totally
fascinated. I still love accents.
With voice actors who could do them and all this other stuff.
And he phased out, which is good because I had a feeling it was about to get real racist.
No. I'm not back yet?
You're back now.
In my storytelling, I started to feel like narratively it almost never made sense for a person to have an accent, for me personally. And even when I see other things, like if I'm watching a movie and someone has, like, it kind of bothers me when I'm watching a film that's supposed to be taking place in another country, you know that these people aren't speaking English to one another, but they're speaking English to one another in the movie with an accent.
With an accent, yes, yes, yes.
And it's like, that doesn't really make sense.
See, and in a performative space, I have come up with a process on this.
So.
And I learned it from some actual plays I watched. I learned it from a lot of things that I'd seen talking about the fact that movie stars frequently do the weirdest voices for no reason and win Oscars for it and shit. And it's not because they're authentic accents. It's frequently just because they're totally bizarre accents. So what I have found is I tend to do less accent and more just goofy voice.
Mm.
And it makes the characters stand out and makes them easily delineated. The other thing I do is I will tend toward accents of demographics that I think are largely not marginalized. So there's 1,000 different British accents. And I use all of them all over the place.
I use
a lot of Western European ones because a lot of those you can sort of get away with it. In general, Scandinavian ones are good because nobody's really making fun of, they're not suffering for, like, that's not a thing. So,
like I said, at some point I realized I didn't really need accents in my narrative, so I didn't use them. And I don't use accents when I role play either, usually, because it starts to get tedious to keep it up. So I just forget about it. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that I made that I did use an accent in was Will versus Chocolate.
Yes, you did.
And I can't quite put my finger on what kind of accent that really is. It sounds Spanish, kind of.
Yeah. I have that accent too. And I call it my Inigo Montoya accent.
Kind of.
And what is funny about it is if I am doing someone Spanish, any Spanish speaker from anywhere, or Italian, or usually French or German, it may not start that way, but eventually it turns into that accent. Every time.
I meant for it to be not a particular nationality at all. I meant for it to be kind of a lusty European Latin, but
Latin.
Not,
there we go.
You know what I'm saying?
I absolutely do.
that's a stereotype in Western storytelling of a Southern European male, seductive whatever. So it wasn't really Spanish, but it was more Spanish than anything else, I suppose. It didn't sound very French or Italian necessarily.
And another way to get around it sometimes, do an impression of a specific person.
Yeah.
Like in that instance, not that I think it was a problem, but had you been concerned, you know what you do in that situation. In that film, you should have just done Ricardo Montalban. Would have fit perfect.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
Wouldn't have been offensive except potentially to Ricardo Montalban if it was really bad.
Well, now, but, to be fair, when I recorded that performance, I wasn't sure that was what was going to be the performance. I mean, it was a reference performance, really. Yeah. I had no idea that I would be voicing the Chocolate even. So I just did what felt like I could give it the right expression and get the right and elicit the right response from the actor.
And I think you did fine. But again, it's a thing to think about. Don't think about it.
Well,
there's not an easy answer. You're always going to be giving it your best guess. And you're always going to have people who think you're being too conservative and too, wishy-washy about it. And people who think you're going too far and being offensive.
The thing is, since a lot of Chocolate comes from South America, it could have come across as me, making fun of, people from South America.
South American chocolate plantation owners.
Or just, people from south of the border.
Well,
which
now
I wasn't
that you pointed
doing.
Out, I think people should boycott that film. I think it's highly offensive.
Well, it's not very popular.
Now
although,
that you pointed it out to me.
Although the chocolate company, some representative of the chocolate company did make a comment on the video.
Nice.
And seemed to like it. So, I don't know.
It's not as popular as, say, my movie.
Doesn't seem to be. I think my movie
is hugely popular.
I think it's pretty funny, but I certainly didn't mean to, offend anybody, but I don't know if it did.
Does my movie genuinely have more views?
I think it might. I haven't looked.
Do you know why it would?
No.
Because I am shameless about plugging it to everyone all the time.
I like all of them.
But I'm always like, I was in a movie, look at this.
To this day, I watch them and I think, these aren't so bad.
I'm hoping this same attitude is what will get me to sell books. Because make no mistake, listeners, when this book gets published in whatever form or place it does, I will be begging, pleading, and harassing you all to purchase it, ideally, but not necessarily, read it, and then tell everyone you know how good it is, whether you feel that way or not, and bug the shit out of them to purchase it as well. This podcast will essentially be just me doing that all the time after it's published. So be ready for that.
That's cool.
Ideally, it becomes like a multi-level marketing thing where I'm like, and if you get three people to buy my book and they get three people to buy my book, like, and then we'll have conventions like where the biggest sellers, you know, come up on stage.
And then there'll be a big stage production with lights and chick, boom, chick, boom, chick, boom, chick.
And eventually we'll get sued and the courts will have to determine whether or not we are a pyramid scheme or not. I'm really excited to discover when, like, to see how that plays out.
Me too. I can't wait.
It requires all of you.
That's right. Everybody's got to help.
All right. You want to be your own boss? We all do. All right. So it's time to go away. So, everybody listen next week and week after that, and then week after that, and then 2 days after that, most of y'all will just be on the podcast with us. So,
and then you'll have to wait several days till it's on. Maybe,
yes,
and people will probably watch it.
Oh, I look so terrible. Does my voice really sound like that?
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.